What's up, everybody? Armand here, back with another episode. Today's guest, we have Chris Joyce. He's the founder of Gusher, and he's been the founder of 24 companies all throughout tech, consumer goods, health, and manufacturing. His products have been sold in more than 11,000 stores in 23 countries. This dude was really awesome to talk to, and in this episode, he gives the formula, pretty much tells everyone how to start a company. We go from different topics, from hiring employee to believing in the mission, how to get an idea, and then how to validate and test that idea and make money from it. This is spaced all throughout different parts of the episode. So yeah, it was really awesome talking to him. I learned a lot. I mean, he's incredibly experienced, very knowledgeable. We also talk about some common themes and red flags that lead to startup failure. So it's been really fun getting to hear, you know, what works and what doesn't. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode of the Play Hard Podcast.
Work hard, play hard. Work hard, play hard. Work
hard, I've been doing this since I was 6 years old. There's a reason, you know? I love physically doing business. I love thinking about business. If I was an artist, maybe I'd have a different form of art. But for me, this is it. This is what I like doing.
I love you mentioning that it is an art, because that's something I've always said, and I've actually gotten into some debates with friends about that. But first, I want to touch on, you said you've been doing this since you were six. What's kind of like the start of your entrepreneurial journey?
Sure. Spider-Man comic book. I saw a biz op ad in the back of a Spider-Man comic book. I sent my $5 via regular mail to get what are called burpee seeds. They're seeds for like vegetables and flowers, watermelon, stuff like that. They sent a pack, a box, I think of 50 of them. And I went door to door selling burpee seeds for $1 a pop. And I grossed $50 on a $5 spend. So I netted 45 and I was off to the races. And, you know, that was not an easy thing to do, especially being six, but it was on an Air Force base. So it was relatively safe. And, you know, you could do that. But you ran into, or I ran into, you know, all the different forms of humanity from a very early age, and it didn't deter me. So, you know, that's what I like doing. So I stuck with it.
What about it did you end up liking at 6 years old? Was it making the money? Was it the challenge of selling through your whole inventory? Like, what drew you into that?
I don't think I think the idea was definitely money. I mean, the eyes of a 6 year old is fundamentally different. You know, as you get older, you may look to get more things from it. I look at my 6 year old that I had, who's now nine, and he started something similar without any prompting, you know, and his main goal was to make money. They're there about money, what they can do with the money. And I think I was wired the same way. It was definitely about the money. Now, not maybe so much, but money is still a good yardstick that I use to measure things.
Yeah. And for the listener, this is Chris Joyce. He's currently the founder of Gusher, but he's also founded, if you couldn't tell from the little intro, about, you know, 24 companies. So he's been all over in tech, consumer goods, health, manufacturing, entrepreneur since day one, it sounds like. What are some of the companies that you've made that have got you here to Gusher?
Sure. Well, I mean, one of my largest was a company called Osolo Foods. It was the largest low-carb manufacturer of foods in the world at the time. It was something that I was basically penniless, almost one step from homelessness when I started that company. And, you know, sleeping on a factory floor for a couple of years, and then it took off like a freaking rocket when it's across the globe. And that was a very fun company. Doing something that I hadn't done before, the manufacturing side of it, that was just extremely, extremely fun.
Sweet. So right now, Gusher, what you're doing is you're helping other entrepreneurs, people who might not necessarily get funding, or they have an idea, but they don't have a way to start that company. What kind of launched that? And how's it doing right now?
Sure. Well, I mean, Gusher is a platform to launch companies without the need for capital, without the need for investors. So what happens is people join companies in exchange for performance-based equity. So what I usually say to founders is, what would you do with $1 million or $2 million in the bank account sitting there right this second? How would you build your company? What would you do? And then Gusher that, because we literally do it all day, every day. I mean, every industry possible, from B2B, B2C, B2B2C, everything in between, B2G even, from consumer goods, manufacturing, SaaS, fintech, AR, VR, AI, gaming, medical device, prop tech, you name it, we've got it. But what really separates it is the success rates. We've got greater than an 80% success rate where these companies become self-sustaining and or attract larger scale capital. So us ourselves, we're growing actually exponentially. We've got more than 350 different companies right now. This time next year, we'll be around 3,500 based upon our current growth trajectory.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. So people put their company, like I'm a founder, I go to Gusher. I look for people to work for me, but give them equity based on their performance.
Right. Think of it this way. It's not like a transactional relationship. So let me explain. So you go ahead typically and you'll have something like a job that maybe a person applies to and they join a company, and a person will join a company regardless of whether they believe in the company or not. If it's a paycheck, because guess what? They have bills, they have to pay it, they have to, you know, cover their overhead, etc. But the teams that come on to Gusher are really fundamentally different. And the example I use a lot of times is a founder by the name of Colin Buckley. He has a company called Happy Howl. And when Colin came into Gusher, he had, the story goes, and it's a really neat story. I'll give you the abbreviated version. But he had a sick dog and literally took it to the vet. And the vet said, you know, put your dog on this dog food, then another dog food, and another dog food. And the dog was a puppy and continued to slowly die. So what he did is he literally hacked a dog food together over 2, 3, 4 months. The dog magically came to life over 3, 4, 5, 6 months. And he wanted to create and form a dog food company. Now, I don't know what you know about a dog food company, but dog food company is extremely competitive. It takes a tremendous amount of capital to be able to penetrate the dog food industry. It's run by gargantuan companies that hold the majority of the market share. I mean, gargantuan. And it's difficult to do. So he put together a team on Gusher. These were people, you know, extreme pros. They had managed $50 million, $100 million, $200 million budgets, companies that you know that I won't mention here. And 6 weeks later, the company imploded. I mean, it literally fell to crap. Now, why am I telling you this story? Because he, after that, listened to me and he created a company with certain people that made up that team. And now a year later, year and a half later, they're worth more than $10 million. They're growing 30, 35% month over month. They took over their own distribution here in Philadelphia locally. They're in large chains like CVS, et cetera, and growing crazy. But what was the difference between the teams is what's important. His first team were these pros, et cetera. His second team, though, all had something in common. The first team did not. Now, this is not a trick question. It's a dog food company. What do you think his second team all had in common that the first team did not?
I'm guessing they all had dogs.
They had dogs. They didn't have kids. They were dog parents. They ate dog, breathed dog, lived dog. They pooped dog. All right. They got the dog industry, the dog market. So because they got it, it was something where they are what's called the vested interest market. They're the people that have the most to gain from the success or failure of that company. Well, when you're building a company with equity, when you don't have a pot to piss in, what you want to go ahead and do is build it up with people that really your idea resonates with. And that's the fundamental difference, is that initial team. And that allows you to leapfrog generational development and end up in a good place much faster.
So it's attracting people that don't just believe in the mission, but live and breathe it every day. Like it's a part of who they are.
Right.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And that's fundamentally different. And I don't want to say it's an easy thing to do. It's not. But what you do in the beginning as a founder, you know, that's the important stuff. It's not creating a technical solution. It's not creating the product. It's not creating the MVP, the minimum viable product. It's creating a market viable product. And the way that you do that is by basically talking to people. And so if you're able to recruit a team, people that believe what you do and see what you see, well, that tells volumes. It tells a lot more than just doing an ad spend.
That brings up a really good point around culture. I was having this conversation with another founder, and the example used was how Airbnb took a full, like when they were ready to hire, they took a full year and a half before they found their very first employee. And I'm sure they could have used the help, the extra manpower, but they wanted someone that fit in and matched their culture and that believed in the mission.
I'm experiencing certain things right now because we're expanding our team massively. And one of the things that we do, and I was talking to my CTO earlier, my CPO, Chief Product Officer, Chief Technology Officer, is I'm like, do you guys realize that we're rejecting more than 99% of applicants right off the bat from first look? Now, we have certain things we look for that are green flags. Yeah. But, you know, I'm sitting there going, my God, this is a gargantuanly high rejection rate. Why are we doing this? And they had to remind me of the fact that, yes, that culture is what we're looking for. We're not looking for just, you know, a team member. We're looking for the right team members for us. And that's something that I preach to founders day and night. You don't need just a team. You need the right team for you. And that's important. That's insanely important.
So, Chris, what is the right team for you and the Gusher culture?
There's a shorthand to dealing with business founders. And one of the shorthands and litmus tests we use, I don't want to give it all away, but there's a way of knowing whether or not a person has that shorthand. There's literally by their interactions and everything else. So I'm going to ask you a question, Armand, all right, real quickly, all right, and I'll demonstrate how we do it. Why do you do what you do? So you've got this podcast here, and I get certain reasons why you went down this road, but, you know, why go down this road? Why go ahead and do this? Why do you do?
Because there's absolutely nothing I love more than talking to people, like first and foremost. Number two, it gets more specific. So like number one, I always knew I'd have some form of like interviewing, talking to people platform. That's just something I'll do for the rest of my life. Number two, my dad's a founder. I studied entrepreneurship. I work at his company and I've always been interested. But I've also always noticed, and I'm sure you can relate speaking to a lot of founders, a lot of times burnout will happen because they don't make time for their family or their fun or things that kind of relax them. One of my dad's co-founders is, in his free time, he's an amateur race car driver. And I was just like fascinated by that. So it just kind of clicked, like, why not have a podcast where I interview entrepreneurs about what they do for fun? And then also I love habits. So habits and hobbies, that just makes for a good show.
So I'm going to dig a little bit deeper here, okay? So I went all the way back to when I was 6 years old and how I started, just because that's literally how I started. All right. So you were literally involved with entrepreneurship almost from the time that you were out of the womb because your dad was a founder. Yeah. All right. So literally you talk founder, you know what it takes. You saw him doing this. You saw the hard conversations, the good, the bad, the ugly,
yeah,
that
yeah,
people don't experience if their dad is an attorney or a doctor. They have a different set of things that they'll run into as a kid. But 100%. You were in it from the time that you were a kid. I don't know if you can see, but I'm getting goosebumps there. All right. And that's kind of what we look for, is that shorthand. You talk it. Okay. And so one of the key indicators is whether or not they have owned a business, whether or not they were part of a startup, even if it's failed, whether or not they had that lemonade stand as a kid, whether or not they yeah. did things. You know, if I'm talking to a developer, chances are, you know, they have a story going back to when they were really young and they started coding HTML yeah. and their first computer. And I talked to them about that and what they owned and what they did, because that's really where the foundation for where a person is as an adult many times is laid at the early stages of being, you know, the kid. And so if they can go ahead and tell you that story and tell that story effectively, that's what we look for many times.
And now that we're talking, I think I've mentioned this story on the show, but my founder origin story was around like 10 or 11 years old. I really wanted a phone and my dad was like, I'll pay for half of it if you can come up with the other half. And it was like around tax season. So I just went to every house with a shredder and said, I'll shred all your documents for money. And then I got a phone.
Brilliant. But that's a brilliant thing. Absolutely. And you got a new, and you put that effort out there. You yeah. literally went door to door or however you did it. And you were able to generate revenue. I mean, what a great lesson to learn. And you were how old?
I think 11, I believe, was the age.
I think you learned everything that you needed to know about entrepreneurship and life at the age of 11. For real.
Yeah, it was fun. And then the next few lessons came when I was a cold caller. That was another one. That's where I learned the
rejection
lessons.
That's brutal. Yeah. That is the most brutal thing.
I know.
By the way, I became a stockbroker at the age of 17 by creating a whole different way of cold calling, which is intense.
Yeah, that sounds like a whole other podcast.
Yes.
All right. So, we touched a little bit how I really do like people's routines. So, yeah, what kind of routines do you have? Do you have like a morning routine for yourself? Any rituals?
I get up freakishly early. I don't go ahead and sit there. The first thing that I do when I get up, and I don't need an alarm. I get up automatically. So I usually get up around 4:05, something like that. But I lift every morning with my 14-year-old son. So we literally go ahead, we hit it very, very early. We accomplish something very difficult as almost the first thing that we do, so that no matter what happens with the rest of the day, we already have that under the belt. And we're not lifting in a nice air conditioned or heated space. We lift in the garage. If it's 20 degrees out, we lift. If it's 90 degrees out, we lift. We don't let anything really interfere with that. We're very disciplined about it.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah, and you're in Philly, right?
Yep.
I remember hearing that. Are you a Birds fan?
Listen, here's the thing. I come from Ohio originally, and in an Air Force family, it's kind of hard to really love one team or the other. But I married into a family that is kind of like, I don't know. I mean, it's like an Irish thing here where you must. Otherwise, they go ahead and kick you out of the family. So yes, go Eagles.
That's funny. I went to Penn State, and all my friends are from Philly. So I definitely got, I was there when they won the Super Bowl. I think it was 2018 or so. But this year, I did not speak to them. That must have been tough.
That big family. My family, extended family, I should say, extremely sports oriented. Big yeah. Sports oriented.
Yeah, that's funny. Did you grow up playing any sports?
I was really horrible. I mean, I did wrestling for a couple of years, and I was absolutely horrible at it. But I started lifting very young. I started lifting when I was 15, 16, and it just stuck. It was something that I loved doing. I liked it because whatever I put into it, I got out of it. It wasn't like, you know, a team sport where, you know, a lot of it's based upon the team. I always wanted my results to be a result of me directly. And one of my first jobs was painting dumbbells at a gym, you know, doing that, going ahead and doing it at the local gym there. But literally, I loved lifting weights. I loved that it was something measurable. You knew if you put an additional 5 pounds on the bar, you knew if you did the couple reps, you knew if you grew by a quarter of an inch. I mean, that may sound like small stuff, but I liked having that objective feedback coming back to me, you know?
Yeah. So what kind of workout routines or lifting routines do you do? Because that's something I started around college, and I'm with you there on, it was just one of those things that I never stopped. It never went away, and it just became so ingrained in me that if I don't work out, it's off. Something's off. Something's weird.
Yeah.
Whether it's like cardio, whether I go, you know, for an hour walk or a hike, but I usually lift 4 days a week. What kind of lifting routines do you have?
Sure. On average, I do about 6 days a week. I'll do a push-pull legs standard, typically push-pull legs, and maybe a day off push-pull legs, but usually 6 days in a row is what I do with one day off. But I also say this, about every 60 to 90 days, I vary it up. So I may end up going ahead and doing some intense anaerobic weight training, not aerobic, but anaerobic. Which is kind of a completely different world, just to screw up my body. Or I may start during the summer running for a month or two as a two-a-dayer to basically shed some pounds and do that also. But I like doing power building, not just bodybuilding, not power lifting, but power building. So it's kind of a combination of the two. And it's pretty good. I mean, it's what enables you to do really both, still look damn good and have a damn good amount of power.
Yeah, that's great. Anything else you do in your routine? So you lift in the morning, first thing with your son. What happens next?
Next is I'm on the cell phone. I deal with companies all across the globe. So it's dealing with whatever emergencies came in during that brief period of time that I was sleeping. So it's putting out fires. I mean, literally, that's what I do for most of my time is putting out fires, helping founders navigate non-standardized issues or issues that they think are non-standard to be able to make them progress, you know, have progress with it. So whether it's dealing with a certain team member or a certain supplier, I've had calls where it comes in at Saturday at 3 or 4 a.m. because the wrong honey was used in a manufacturing run. Or Fridays after 4 p.m., that's when the Walmart orders come in and they're kind of shitting in their pants going, how the hell am I going to do this? Get this, you know, deal off the ground. So it's really just taking the calls first thing in the morning. It's really video calls that I do. I rarely do phone calls, just video.
So you mentioned a little bit about progress. How do you measure progress amongst these companies? Like, what kind of metrics do you look at for anyone that you're working with?
First and foremost, we have one main thing that really determines whether or not the company is going to be quote unquote successful. So we don't have tons of metrics that we follow. It's really this one thing. And I kind of touched on it earlier, but if a founder is able to recruit one person, I mean, literally all it takes is one person for performance-based equity, those are the companies that move forward. Those are the companies that become self-sustaining. Those are the companies that attract larger scale capital if they need it. Those are the companies that make progress. So we have a saying on Gusher, 1 + 1 doesn't equal 2. 1 + 1 equals done. And so it all comes down to the ability to recruit one person into your company that sets the founders that do from the founders that don't. That's our main KPI. Yeah. After that, it becomes a whole slew of stuff.
That's fascinating. Why is that?
Because think about it. In order to go ahead and bring on somebody for equity, okay, it's a different thing. So as I said earlier, anybody will join your company for a paycheck. I mean, they would typically, all right, unless you know there's something controversial or something like that. But and if they need it, they would still do it. But for performance-based equity, it takes the ability to go ahead and resonate with people on a fundamental human level where either they get it or they don't. So if you have the ability to be authentic, and I mean really authentic, if you have the ability to ask questions and really get to know that person and see if it's a fit, that fundamentally separates the founders that do from the founders that don't. But what it also does is that's required to penetrate the market at the next steps. So after you have the product, you're going to have to speak that language anyway to penetrate the market. And if you've able to talk to the market now successfully, well, then logically it should be where you're penetrating and able to resonate with investors. So it really is a function, that first function of getting your pitch down and resonating with trying to bring somebody into your company. If you can't do it, it means your pitch sucks, your ability to resonate sucks, your authenticity isn't there, and you damn well better iterate or get the crap out. I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
And how are these companies interviewing for that performance-based equity? Like, what's that process look like?
The process is kind of like what we're doing now. I say it's the easiest hard work or the hardest easy work there is. The fact of the matter is, it's just speaking with somebody face-to-face. It's got to be face-to-face. You don't use text. You don't use chat. You don't do anything like that. You get face-to-face and talk with them. And in a world of video, when you're building up teams, they're going to be all over the globe. My team is all over the globe. So you're going to be dealing with off hours and doing just what we're doing right now. But the key is also to not treat it like an interview. It's not an interview. It's more like internet dating. You're there to really find out if there is alignment, if there is philosophical alignment, if there is, you know, that's really important stuff.
Yeah, I totally agree. One thing I've noticed, and this is definitely something I mentioned in the podcast before, is I started looking into like the generational differences, a little bit of background. Like I was really fascinated on why different generations act differently or have like these stereotypes towards them. And it all comes down to like what, you know, major world events were going on during your adolescence, like during your stamping years. And I found my generation, Generation Z, is very much interested in their career, like they're very career focused, but they don't want to work for someone that they don't believe in, that they don't feel like their mission is doing something. And another big thing is they want to work for people that are kind of like social activists, like treating the world well, having like green companies and things like that. So it's been really interesting. But yeah, it's like the new generation of the workforce is very work oriented, but towards a specific mission, rather than working for whatever company will hand out a paycheck.
Yeah, but I could also make the following argument, right? And I'm going to say this. So, you know, not that I grew up in the 60s or anything else, but if you look back at the 60s, okay, almost in a way, there was that movement along the similar thoughts, you know, and in the 80s, you know, maybe not so much. So I wonder if it's something that cycles regularly between generations. Yeah. So it may have a different flavor, you know, Gen Z from, let's say, the 60s or whatever it may be. But I don't know really if there's fundamentally much difference. I think that really, yes, there's different tools. Yes, there's different things that your generation had that other generations didn't. But I tend to think that people are people and they almost in a way evolve a certain way. And I don't think there's much differences between, you know, the generations now and the generations before. I think that if anything, the one generation is aging and they like to comment on the younger generation that is also aging.
Yeah.
If you play back and you look at the news, every damn generation was like that before, where they're talking about the younger generation coming up, you know?
Oh, I definitely agree with that. I definitely think it cycles. And my guess is it just cycles with what's going on with the world at that time, or like where you're living.
But also, you know, to your point regarding impact, I mean, that's who doesn't want to have impact? People, they don't have to anymore necessarily work for a company that doesn't have impact. You know, so for us, you know, these companies come together for impact. It's not just, you know, that paycheck. It's having something that they could be involved in and an impact in to breathe them to life. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. People can find meaning in multiple different ways. If I got bored doing what I was doing, I'd be on to the next thing. I couldn't work at something that I didn't have an impact on or didn't go ahead and have an impact upon the world. And when I was 6 years old, it was about making money. Now it's about untapping human potential. That's how it evolves.
I totally agree. And to get back to Gusher, like the reason that all came up is because it seems like this is a really good platform for people to find something. And what better way of measuring, like, I'm going to go work for someone based on what I believe than performance-based equity? So it totally makes sense.
100%. But it also allows people to make sure that they're in alignment. Because, you know, if you ask most people have excess time.
Yeah.
And trying to have something that impacts it. Yeah, you can have a side hustle or whatever it is. And if you're wired for that, do it. Go for it. But a lot of people are not. They want to be part of something that's bigger. They know what they're good at. They want to just use those skills in the same way. Just get another horse in the race that they have ownership in. And I think that's fair.
That's a good way of looking at it. Another horse in the race with ownership. That's pretty great. Does anyone do work for some of these companies as a side hustle?
Yeah, well, think of it this way. We have certain people that are involved with multiple startups. Yeah. So the way they view it is they view it as their portfolio. So they're coming on as maybe the CMO, or they're coming on as, you know, a lead developer or whatever it may be. And they're involved with multiple companies and treating it literally like a portfolio.
Yeah, that makes sense. I remember a year or two ago when kind of like Web3 and crypto startups were really starting to get a lot of funding and money was coming in. They didn't have that many developers. So it was not uncommon for one developer to be working on like three or four different companies and projects. And it was just kind of like breaking the mold of, if you're working for this company, like you sign the contract, you're only here from 9 to 5, like that. It was definitely just like throwing that out of the water because there just wasn't enough talent to meet the demand.
Exactly. And I think that's a good thing. I think when you have flexibility, you have competition, you have options, you have more options sitting in front of you, all that can be is a good thing. I mean, it dilutes it in one certain respect, but it also allows the cream to rise to the top.
At the same time, it's like, if you're able to deliver on multiple different projects and it brings you fulfillment, like, who are you really harming, you know? Is it like the company loyalty? That's kind of becoming a thing of the past, unless you do believe in that company well. But even then, you can believe in two different missions.
Yeah. I mean, are we supposed to be linear cogs? I mean, that is a nice quaint theory, our old way of viewing things, but we're not wired that way. We have more options. Anytime there's more options, it's a good thing. It's market economics. I think that's phenomenal.
So working with a lot of these companies, what are some of the common patterns that you see that tend to lead towards failure instead of success?
That's interesting. So a low emotional intelligence for a founder almost always spells death. That literally spells death from a human perspective, okay? Another red flag that you look at, and these are companies that come to Gusher after this, okay? Because most of ours aren't like this, but they create a technical product, a technical solution for a problem without taking the human element into consideration. So what do I mean by that? I mean, a bunch of the tech companies that are created out of Silicon Valley are created ass backwards. So they go ahead, they create this great technical solution, and then they worry about product market fit. Well, companies were not created like that, you know, a long, long time ago in ages. You had to create a company that was basically self-sustaining almost from the very beginning. But the way that you do that is by bringing in that CMO to be able to figure out the personas and markets and path to monetization. You bring in the creative director for basically creating the voice to resonate in an authentic way with these markets. Now you bring in social media to be able to have a warm community to launch successfully into. Why am I bringing up all these other types of roles? The reason is because these are the roles that result in a fundamentally different product if brought in from the beginning. And tech companies don't do that. They usually bring it as an afterthought after they've created the company, which now these people are all trying to sell this piece of shit that really hasn't been framed the right way. So, you know, you were asking about red flags or how, you know, for failure. Well, you know, the biggest thing is that if these companies don't realize that they are really a sales and marketing company from the beginning, So if they don't realize they're a sales and marketing company from the very beginning, even if it's a tech company, even if it's a scientific company, that's typically spells doom.
Yeah, that's interesting. I do remember hearing this one term. It's similar to a problem that happens with startups when you focus on the solution first and then you try and find a problem it solves later rather than focusing on the problem and coming up with a solution to it. And that makes total sense.
Yeah. Here's what I say, all right? Before you should be even doing any of that in terms of creating anything, start talking to people and watch what happens. If you're able to talk to them and you're able to see the light bulbs go off and you get the heads nodding as they're talking to you, you may have something.
Yeah.
If not, good luck. Because that part right there, the ability to communicate what you're building or going to build or going to solve, that's even more important than the actual solution. The solution can be a total piece of crap. But if you're communicating it effectively where you're going, you'll still have people that join you.
Interesting. Like hypothetically, let's say your brain was placed in some random person. So your network's gone, your reputation's gone, everything's gone. And now you want to start a company from scratch. How would you go about doing that?
So if I had nothing, absolutely
yeah,
nothing.
Absolutely.
The first nothing. The first thing I do is I'd wake up and I'd say, my God, oh my God, I'm in a horrible position. What it may be. And I'd start realizing what my problems are. All right. And from whatever problems I'm having, whatever scenario that I'm in, wherever I am, those problems are literally the pathway to a business. So it's either figuring out and isolating a problem and my own personal issue on that. And then I'd start talking to people. Just start talking to people about the problem. Start really seeing if there may be a solution. You don't have to have a solution. If enough people have that problem, well, then you can start finding people to go ahead and actually create a solution or create a path. So it all starts with the problem. It starts with myself and internally what I hear, whatever that little voice is that talks to me. If a lot of people say no, 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 and they're shitting on an idea, well, that makes me double down on it. That makes me think that, okay, maybe there is something here. I'm just not figuring the way to communicate it and figure the way to put it out there. But it starts from internally every time.
Interesting. So like trusting your gut, trusting that little voice that kind of has the answers already.
Well, think of it this way. You grew up in an entrepreneurial environment. I did not grow up in an entrepreneurial environment. So I had from a very young age, my ideas were shit upon. But that was great because it actually set me up for my future where, okay, it doesn't bug me at all if anybody thinks that the idea is crap. It allows me to make progress in a different way. In terms of being people and the way that they're brought up and educated and everything else, most times we're taught to ignore that little voice inside, to go ahead and push it down, that part that is, hey, I've got this new idea. Hey, I think I can do this. Hey, take the risky route. We're taught not to do that typically by most families, by the culture, by most school systems. And that's really the voice that you should listen to, because on your deathbed, you're going to be regretting it if you don't.
Yeah, that's very true. And it's the more you listen to it, the more right that voice ends up getting too.
That's right. And that's something that it gets stronger. It's kind of like an ember of a fire. We're all born with that. We have it. And either you start putting it out and listening to other people, or you cultivate it and you treat it, you know, and before you know it, it's a big fire, something that's burning really greatly. That's what it's about. And many times you can bring that back to life, even though you've killed it for decades.
How would you do that?
You have to start with going ahead and looking in the mirror, and whatever makes you smile, do. That's the key. You literally have to do what makes you smile on that. Even as it sounds like the most stupid ass idea, the worst idea in the world, it's not about the idea. It's about doing something that really you feel you should be doing, something that really resonates with you. Why would you not? I mean, the idea is not an end game. It's not an end point. It's a starting point. Who knows where that idea leads?
You have no idea how many people I've talked to about that. And I'm not just talking like founders and entrepreneurs, just any walks of life about, you know, your gut feeling and how would you cultivate it better. And the amount of people who I respect for their wisdom very much have said, do what makes you smile. Like those words, those exact words. Do what makes you happy. Do what you find fun. Do what makes you smile.
Yeah, that's... you're not going to regret it because at least you did what you thought was right.
Yeah, very true.
I mean, what should you do? Do what you think is wrong and do what you don't want to do and do what other people say you should do. I mean, that's badass, batshit crazy.
So now let's talk about some of the stuff that makes you smile, which from what it sounds like, we talked a little earlier before the show started, is looking at other businesses.
I'm a very simple person. I'm very linear. I'm very simple. I like businesses. I mean, literally, I get off on it. I mean, it's the type of thing that I love doing. I love analyzing them. I love driving around. I love visiting them. I love seeing products on shelves. I like touching them. I like feeling it. I like seeing good design. I bitch about bad design. I bitch about bad products and say how I would improve it. I like doing business pretty much nonstop. It's what I do.
What are some of the trends and patterns that you've noticed recently in businesses, whether good or bad?
Sure. Well, the one thing is design has definitely elevated, meaning that good design has become something where it's not an exception anymore. Let's say you're a consumer good or consumer product. Your consumer good or consumer product has to be at a certain level almost from the very beginning that before, and I'm talking just 5-10 years ago, would have been considered really inferior or a beginner type of product. But now you have to be a hell of a lot more advanced by doing that. And the good thing is that, you know, good designers, they're now easily found. It's easier to go ahead and locate them. But the same thing also with, let's say, app creation, creating an app and everything else, or some even web applications, the skill level at where it needs to be has to be much, much, much higher to be able to penetrate at all. You can't come out with just these rough ideas anymore. It's something where really it has to be refined to be able to penetrate at all.
Interesting. The design and app thing makes a lot of sense because there's a lot more people with that skill. It's not easier to do that skill, but it's easier to learn. There's a lot more resources available to learn the different skill sets. So I'm sure the standard's just gone up. There's more people in the market. You can find designers easily, app creators.
Yeah, but the funny thing is penetrating those markets hasn't changed. All right. Meaning that the vast majority of distribution, yes, you can make a case for internet and direct to consumer and influencer marketing, but the vast majority of penetrating these markets initially to be able to get momentum requires doing the stuff that's not scalable. And you talked earlier about, and you just touched on it regarding cold calling or whatever it may be. Well, guess what? That still is probably the best damn path to getting your product into mass distribution. And that's not scalable. All right. It's not something that you can go 1 and 10x. You're still that main person, whether your company's doing 100 grand or 10 million or 100 million to penetrate those marketplaces.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Oh, wow, that's really interesting. So one kind of founder trope or like saying that people say a lot, I'm really curious about if it's true or not. They say first-time founders are focused on product and second-time founders are focused on distribution. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that if you're dealing with the standard VC industry, the incubators, the accelerators, whatever it may be, that that may be correct. That's the pattern that that model generates. For us, it's not. We create our stuff backwards. Us is creating a self-sustaining model from the very beginning. So meaning that all that is taken in conjunction, product market fit, distribution, everything else, that really has to be thought of from the very, very beginning and done a certain way to get the revenues. When you put the revenues first and foremost, and I'm not saying making that your God, but what ends up happening is you take the market into consideration as the important. You take the product, you take the distribution, very, very important because really it's about monetization. If you can't keep the doors open, you're not going to get to the next level. At all, zero.
So what are some tips you have for founders on monetizing really quick and easy from the beginning?
Sure. Well, first of all, you don't need a product to be able to monetize or determine if it's going to be able to penetrate. So let me give a quick bad example, all right? But it's a low-tech example. If I have a consumer good, I don't need to have that physical consumer good. I can create an easily one-page document, a one-pager on a website, whatever the hell it may be. I can then go ahead and contact the main buyers of certain chains or independent stores. And let me tell you something, within 3 to 7 days, you're going to know whether you're onto something or whether you're going to be facing an uphill battle every step of the way. So one of our products, which I can't go ahead and name because I'm under NDA because we sold the company to a pharma company. Before we even had the product, we contacted the main buyers of like Target, of Walmart, of all these things with a one pager and an email. And we know that when we got all these meetings set up, that guess what? That product's going to penetrate. And that took approximately 2 days of design effort to do. I mean, very low cost before we actually created the product. And you can do that at a local level. I mean, whether it's from going ahead and putting flyers on cars to knocking on doors to taking advantage of your social network and asking your friends with DMs or your direct contacts, you can do all that stuff, low cost, no cost, just to be able to test. You know, it costs nothing to test.
Interesting. How do you go about setting up one of those tests? Because that sounds like that's the key to seeing whether or not an idea is going to catch or not, is having the right test.
Well, it depends what you're talking about, okay? So if I'm talking about recruiting a team, that's one thing to be able to get the company going. Yeah. If I'm talking about I have a new pen, I don't want to penetrate it. Well, obviously, you have to have some image, first of all, first and foremost. Your imagery is going to be primary. Now, literally, you can go and use AI to generate tons of stuff that can then be crafted into other things, but you just need some basic stuff there in terms of the imagery. The next thing you need to do is basically have three or four, five selling points, unique selling points of differentiation. Then you're going to go ahead and need a list, potential candidates or potential targets to be able to test. And then you're literally going to craft an outbound, either email or however you're going to go about reaching them. Email is the best for initial because, again, no cost. But you need to have a tracking mechanism on that email, sort of something like Yesware, which I'll plug. They're not a company of ours, but we use them religiously. And then you're going to test that, send that email out with that one pager to whoever those targets are, see how many opens you get, see how what the subject heading variations, and go through all that rigmarole. And that's basically the way you do it. But the first step is, what's your idea? Get the idea out there. Talk to people. That's the way you do it.
Chris, if someone were to piece together this episode the right way, they just have the formula to make a company. They have, you know,
you do.
Idea creation. You got how to validate that, how to hire employees. Like, perfect, man. That's awesome.
That's good.
Yeah. I mean, this is, you like you said, you live and breathe this every day. This is fantastic. All right. Now it's time for the closing questions. They're just a couple quick questions before wrapping up the show. Are you ready?
Yeah, definitely.
Sweet. They're more fun. What kind of music do you listen to?
Oh, God, I listen to everything from techno to heavy metal to you name it. Who's my kid has me listen to Ice Spice right now. I mean, freaking everything.
That's awesome.
So, and people find that crazy. So everything from Vivaldi to Ice Spice.
That's going to be the show title right there. What kind of movie or TV shows would you recommend?
Okay, I'm very boring when it comes to that. I either like extreme dialogue or extreme action. Anything to do with teenagers or kids' angst or anything like that, I run from. Why do I say that? Because my wife is the opposite, which makes it very difficult to watch anything.
Yeah, that's what, she likes the teen dramas.
Yeah, oh, my God. Yeah.
What about books? What kind of books are you reading?
I don't anymore. And I know that sounds absolutely crazy and goes against everything, but there's a reason I'm kind of ADHD with books. If I go ahead and pick up, or I should say OCD. If I go ahead and pick up a book, I have to read it to the end without putting it down. All right. Which was great for college because I'd finished courses in a weekend, but horrible as an adult. So I stick with magazines or something else.
Oh, nice. Yeah, no, I've lately been on the opposite. I've just been starting as many books as I can, and like, if something interests me, I'll keep reading it. If not, like, I'll stop being afraid of putting them down. I used to be like, I have to finish this book and all that. But lately, I've been taking that pressure off and just say, hey, man, you like reading. Let's try a bunch of different stuff until one sticks. And I'm like, right now,
I think
now,
that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah. I heard in this one podcast, this guy treats books like they're blogs. And that's kind of what I've been trying to do. You skim them. If something's really grabbing your attention, you go over it. But like the other day, I was reading this one book where I really liked it, but I felt like it would be better for me in a few years, but not exactly right now. It just didn't match what my life's kind of doing right now. So I just put it down, started another one.
That's a good way. I mean, for me, I look at it as like, do I want to make the investment? And I'm like, do I have other things I can invest in that give me a better ROI? So that's the stage I'm at.
Yeah. And then last question is, where can people find you and your company?
Sure. You can find us at gusher.co, G-U-S-H-E-R.co. I'm easily found. I mean, I'm pretty big on LinkedIn, not much on the other social networks, but you can find me anywhere.
Yeah, I'll throw all that in the below. Chris, thank you so much for joining. Thanks for giving the listeners the formula to start a company. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Armand.